Welcome to the Together PDX podcast. You're listening to our Gospel Gathering series, where we will be replaying valuable content from past events where local Portland leaders gathered to hear from authors, theologians, and scholars. We'd like to note that the views shared by our guests don't necessarily reflect those of the entire Together PDX team. We pray today's content enriches your day and spirit. Hey everyone, I'm Elise Gallus, and today I'm excited to share with you a recording from a gospel gathering we just did in the fall of 2022 on how to inhabit time. Professor and award-winning author James K.A. Smith shows us that awakening to the spiritual significance of time is crucial for orienting faith in the 21st century. Now, I don't know that that's a topic I had ever even considered before hearing Jamie talk last fall, and if I'm honest, I kind of thought that it may go way over my head. But I was so blown away by this talk, and I wasn't alone. As soon as this was over, I was getting emails all over the place from people who wanted the recording to listen again or share it with a spouse or a coworker. People loved it. So I'm excited to share it with you today. Enjoy part one of James K.A. Smith's October 2022 talk, How to Inhabit Time.
I wanted to point out to you, I think of you all often, because every time I open my iPad, it is the Japanese garden in Portland. I don't know how, I've had this on here for years, it's just a wonderful, every time, this is like a space of joy for me, and so it's a treat to be back here. I feel like this is a place where I am known and know some of you, and so I'm really grateful for a chance to spend a morning with you and in conversation. It really meant a lot to me what John said. I think one of the things I'm trying to do is help leaders and pastors kind of drill wells that you might not know when you will have to drink from. Do you know what I mean? Like, I'm not the guy, you don't come to my workshop because here's like the seven things you're going to do this week that will change your ministry. It's more, I'm okay with like people saying, I don't know what he's talking about. But I feel like we're building capacity for the things that we don't know we're coming. That's why I absolutely love my job. I literally just get to be a student my whole life and somebody pays me to do it. And I think that sense of just incessant curiosity and hunger for learning and expanding and that we don't have to instrumentalize it or commodify it or know exactly how we're going to immediately implement it. I think investing in that kind of intellectual formation is just a huge spiritual strength for pastors. And so I'm really, really excited that you're all here, and because to me it tells me that you're the kind of people who care about that. So we've got two sessions together this morning. What I'm gonna do is, let's say the first session, the book, How to Inhabit Time, kind of toggles back and forth between thinking sort of socially, systemically, collectively, and communally, and then thinking very personally and individually and internally, as it were. And I think the themes that interest me about time and temporality and mortality play on both of those levels. So I thought what we would do, and this was kind of Ken's suggestion, is let's think of this first session as doing a bit of the sort of macro, cultural, social diagnosis work a little bit about why time matters. And then after the break, we'll come back and we'll dive into something that I think is probably a little more sort of personal and individual and something that we can drink up for ourselves. So we'll operate on kind of two levels here. The other thing, I guess I'm just gonna say this from the front. A lot of you spend time going to other places and speak too. Do you notice that when you go other places, you don't always know where the landmines are? Do you know what I mean? So I'll just admit, I don't know where all the landmines are. And if I step on one of your landmines, just trust me for a little while, okay? Just give me the benefit of the doubt till we get to the next part of the conversation. Now Ken is like totally freaking out. He's like, oh my gosh, what's good? It's not that. But I'm asking you, let's covenant to trust one another, even if we sort of lean into some difficult things. Is that okay?
Is that cool?
So let's think about, guys, what do I have to do to bring up my first? There we go. Not a digital native. Expect nothing from slides. But I want us to think through some of the ways that time matters for the Christian life. Why time matters. Why when makes a difference. And if there is a kind of overarching question we're asking today, the question is, when are we? When are we? We're used to the sort of the spatial question, where are we? And disorientation. I want to suggest that our disorientation that we experience is actually a kind of temporal dislocation, because it's not just that we don't know where we don't know when we are. And if we are going to ask that question, when are we, we're going to require a different kind of attunement, if you will, to our souls and to our surroundings. So I want to spend this first session spending a little time exploring why that question feels strange for us. Why the question, when are we, is a weird question for us. And we'll do some diagnosis of kind of our social and spiritual condition in this regard. And then we'll pivot and consider what it looks like, I think, to take time seriously for the task of Christian formation, spiritual formation, and so forth. Any authentic spirituality has to be rooted in a deep sense of our creaturehood. Our creaturehood. I think the most powerful and helpful visions for the Christian life, from ancient desert dwellers to 20th century giants like Nouwen and Merton, I think what they share in common is actually a deep attunement to our finitude. The fact that we are creatures. In fact, Thomas Merton once said that too many works of spiritual counsel amount to instructions for how to be an angel. And I think that still very much holds true. There are a lot of versions of holiness and discipleship and spirituality that are effectively counsels to evade or somehow transcend our creaturehood, our humanity, our embodiment. And I think that those modes of spirituality and formation and discipleship are doomed to disappointment in addition to being wrong. Because in Jesus Christ, God did not become an angel. God became human. We're talking about an incarnate spirituality. And the only spirituality that could promise really any true hope or wisdom for us has to be a spirituality for humans, for creatures. So here's the fundamental conviction I want to work out with you today. A spirituality for creatures must be a spirituality attuned to time and history. Now, this is where I think I'm trying to sort of advance our conversation. If you think of how many know, like, Dallas Willard, right? Richard Foster, Tish Warren, Dorothy Bass, you know, all kinds of really, really significant and encouraging conversations about spiritual formation. I think in the last 15 years, we've seen incredible growth in this regard. What one of the threads of that I think at least has been underemphasized or underarticulated, under-theorized, has been the fact that we are temporal creatures, that we inhabit time and history. To be human is to be conditioned by time and to be shaped by history. So we don't float above the flux. We are those unique creatures who are shaped by history, even as we are the creatures who shape history. So this is why I want to try to dig into why it feels strange for us to ask the question, when are we? And I think we need to undertake a diagnosis of what is it about the forms of Christianity that I think many of us are familiar with and have been formed by that have made us ill-attuned to time and history and temporality. And it seems to me that there is something in the water of American culture that then seeps into the water of different kinds of American Christianities that make us imagine that we are somehow ahistorical or supra-temporal, above time. And if I think about, like, what causes that, what is it that makes us imagine that we are ahistorical creatures, I think you could imagine different kinds of causes for that. One is, you know, just the prototypical sort of American overconfidence in our willpower. Do you know what I mean? Like, this is baked into the DNA of sort of, especially, I wonder if you feel it, especially in the West, where you get the legacies of the sort of frontier spirit, as it were. And right, we are the chargers, we are the ones who can sort of be self-dependent, independent, self-sufficient. And there's this deep sense in which it doesn't matter where I've come from or what we've done. In the next moment, I always have the willpower to make the next decision. So I think sometimes our overconfidence in our own willpower makes us think that we're not shaped and subject to time. I think there's also a certain kind of misplaced confidence in our own ingenuity and enlightenment. And I think this is, honestly, I do think that this is a really, really significant trope in our tech sector, which thinks it doesn't matter what our history was. The whole point of that is to disrupt history so that we can now do it all new and different and revolutionize. And then I think spiritually there's all kinds of ways in which we've imagined that because we have a revelation from the eternal God, that somehow we get to play as if we are eternal. Do you know what I mean? As if, so I notice, I'm not for a second questioning that we have a revelation from the eternal God. What I'm saying is there's a difference between understanding that and then imagining that that house somehow skyhooks me out of time and out of history. I think there's all kinds of ways that there's these sort of tropes and forces in American culture that make us imagine that we are ahistorical and supra-temporal. And the result of that, though, is really disorientation, a temporal disorientation, because it stems from the illusion that we are above the fray, or that we are immune to history, or that we are surfing time rather than immersed in it and battered by its waves. So I'm going to call this, those kinds of forms of things, know-when Christianities. Have any of you ever heard, I don't know if only philosophers talk this way, has anybody ever heard people talk about the view from nowhere? The supposed view from nowhere? So some people think they have this, like, I see everything purely and clearly and perfectly because I have a standpoint that isn't located and contextual, so I have a view from nowhere. Well, in a similar way, what I'm suggesting is we can subtly fall into imagining that we have a view from no-when. Right? That we are not located in time or history. But the result actually is you think you are ahistorical, but the way that plays out is as temporal disorientation in time. So those who imagine that they are sort of, they inhabit this know-when, imagine themselves just purely and wholly governed by timeless principles and unchanging convictions, and they are sort of devoted to this kind of idealism that thinks, well, all that matters for me are eternal ideas. I'm immune to history. They're oblivious, I would add, to the deposits of history in their own unconscious. They have never considered the archaeological strata of their own souls. We live as if we were hatched, as if we weren't formed by a process. And where that sort of notion of an eternal know when governs, time doesn't matter. And the result is something like a kind of temporal tone deafness, as it were. What I mean is, when you imagine that you surf above time or float above time, you're above the fray, you also actually lack the capacity to see and read and appreciate the nuance and texture of history and of the moment in which you find yourselves, right? It's kind of, you're sort of oblivious to why time matters, which means that you are terrible at reading the signs of the times. We can't discern why when makes a difference. So we don't recognize how much we are the products of a past, for a start. We think we're hatched by the eternal God. And because we don't realize how much we are the products of a past, I think it leads to a remarkable naivete about the present. Now, I'll add, and we'll get to talk about this, it also means we don't know how to keep time with the future. Right? If you don't know how to happen in time, you also don't really know how to be an eschatological people. We'll talk about this in a second. Let me give you an example of this. Look, when several years ago, in the wake of brutal police violence and the clear systemic data that showed us the disproportionate ways in which Black Americans suffer under police violence in this country, and people started to assert and protest that Black lives matter, there were all kinds of white Americans, and not a few white Christians, who in response said, what? All lives matter. Okay. To me, and we can talk about this, so I'm glad John gave us permission to disagree, that to me is an example of a know-when response. It's an example, because, and what it will say is, well, look, we're traffic, oh, by the way, it was a little curious to all of a sudden see a bunch of white Americans be great strident purveyors of universal human solidarity, I'll just say. But all of a sudden, in the face of this protest that Black lives do matter in this country, when in response somebody asserts the eternal and universal truth that all lives matter, it's false. I want us to say it's false. Not because it violates some eternal principle. It's false now, here, given this history, given what got us to this moment. When makes a difference? And if when doesn't make a difference, then what happens is people get very selective about when the eternal matters. So what happens is, and notice, of course, it is, let's say, ontologically or metaphysically true that all lives matter. But we live in a time and a place where some clearly haven't. And so the strategic move of asserting the universal and eternal when you are dealing with the particular and the temporal and the historical in a place and a time is unfaithful. It's an unfaithful response to the present in which we find ourselves. So this is what I mean by the way in which kind of know-when Christianities can actually generate, they generate unfaithful responses. So let's think a little bit about what I think are some of the common temptations. I'm going to call these temporal temptations. Temporal temptations that we can fall into as disordered ways of inhabiting time. You know, so the book is called How to Inhabit Time. The short story is, you can't not inhabit time. It's not whether or not to inhabit time. If you're a creature, you inhabit time. The question is how. So let me name a few examples that I think the how gets disordered, okay? The first is, I wonder if some of us will be familiar, and I'm just going to give a little bit of my own testimony in this regard, is there are all kinds of expressions of Christianity that seem to be fixated on time and history that are, in fact, and ironically, know-when renditions of the faith. Because it looks like they're fixated on what's happening in history, but they actually assume that they have a know-when posture of perspective on it all. And the example I'll give is, so I was not raised in the church. I became a Christian when I was 18 in 1988. And I became a, and I, by the way, this is just my story. I don't know where we're all coming from. This is my pathway into Christ. And, my wife was doing a little missionary dating at the time. And, her family were part of what was called the Plymouth Brethren tradition. I don't know if anybody would know that. There's all kinds of reasons not to know it. But, it was in 1998. It was a tradition in which prophecy and sort of rapture and end times was huge. And some of you might be old enough to remember that there was this pamphlet going around in 1988 called 88 Reasons for 1988, which is, this is why the rapture is happening, which, by the way, I would love to find in a used bookstore right now. My experience of coming into Christian faith was through this stream of Christianity that was actually really, really absorbed by current events and the events of history. In fact, in the basement of the little rural chapel where I was first discipled was this massive banner. Some of you are recognizing this. This is one of Clarence Larkin's famous charts. And this is the chart that actually purports to give us the entire 7,000 year history of you. We talk about that later. But what's fascinating is, and this was, so every Wednesday night when we had Bible study, that is the wall, and we are working our way through history, right? The entirety of human history. What I want to point out, I'm not here to pick on dispensationalism. What I want to point out is that on the one hand, this looks like a form of Christianity that is fascinated by history. But in fact, the charts and predictions manifest a Christianity that is above history. We know exactly how everything has gone and is going to go because we're not subject to history. We have the standpoint outside of history. And in fact, what also happens here, and it took me a long time to figure this out, history itself in this rendition is just the regrettable grind of waiting for the end to come. It's the churn of degeneration. It is literally a countdown to demise. That's the only reason that history is unfolding, is to get to the end where it's all burned up. And what happens is, in this rendition, long chunks of history, including a long phase of Christianity that goes something like between the death of the last apostle and the advent of John Nelson Darby in 1828, all the intervening history is devoid of the Spirit. Is an era of illusion. It is an era of superstition, of deception. And so instead of actually discerning history, what's going on in a no-win form of Christianity is actually a demonization of most of history. So one form of no-win Christianity manifests itself as this kind of end times fixation that actually has no place to imagine why God gives us history as a gift. There's no way, no positive theological articulation of why history might be a gift. I'll probably say this multiple times, but one of my favorite lines while working on this book came from Gustavo Gutierrez in his book, Theology of Liberation, where he says, to hope in Christ is at the same time to believe in the adventure of history. To hope in Christ is at the same time to believe in the adventure of history. This sort of know-when rendition doesn't have a way to imagine how God is with us in history, is working in history. It's also why, by the way, it's very, very hard for these forms of Christianity, know-when Christianity, to articulate any sense of a cultural call of the church to be faithful to Portland. To actually be an agent of redemption and renewal to a city, other than to keep extending invitations to the escape pod. Right? There's something going on there. I just want us to notice that there's a kind of theological paucity of what's possible in this story. So, let's say the first kind of temporal temptation is a form of end times fixation. The second one, and these, by the way, these sometimes go together, is what I'm going to call primitivism. Primitivism. I think this will also feel familiar to many of this. It's certainly something I've experienced. Primitivism is a curious way view of history that sees God's presence limited to only certain key points in history. And what happens is, most importantly, in these primitivist Christianities, it assumes that the Spirit was present in the first century, and then somehow absent and forgotten for the long intervening centuries until someone, usually their guy, and it's almost overwhelmingly a guy, right? Until their guy figured out the secret and restored that primitive, original, authentic faith, right? And this is kind of the recipe of what we call in American history of religion, revivalism. And so what happens is then you get the renewal movement that recovers the original deposit. But again, notice what happens. Vast swaths of history are written off as, to use a good King Jamesy word, Ichabod. I feel like I learned this as when I was in Pentecostalism. Ichabod. God has left the building, right? The Spirit is absent. Devoid. And in this picture, long swaths of history are Ichabod, devoid of God's presence, because that history doesn't conform to their contemporary version of the original. And what I want us to realize is this sets us up to spurn the gifts of the Spirit that were given in those intervening centuries. Now, I think that kind of what I'm calling primitivism, right? Going back to the first, to the beginning. I will say this. I think that's a collective and social and cultural reality. I do want to just note though that I think there are personal, individual versions of primitivism, which I'm going to call first love-ism. And what I mean is there are versions of sort of spirituality that kind of romanticize and idolize and sacralize the first experience of Christ as if that's the only authentic expression of what it looked like to follow Jesus. Do you know what I mean? In other words, I'm talking about those forms of spirituality that imagine that the way I loved and knew and experienced the joy of Jesus when I converted at 18 years old is the paradigm and measure of what authentic spirituality looks like. And then what, if you sort of fall into that, here's what happens. By the time you are 50, you are just going to constantly feel guilty that you don't feel that way. We'll talk about that a little bit more after the break. Third kind of temporal temptation, and in some ways this might be the most powerful one that we are facing right now, is nostalgia. Nostalgia. As the people of God, absolutely, that means that we are called to be a people who remember. The question of, if you hear anything from me today, it's always how. The question isn't whether we remember, the question is how we remember. And nostalgia is the name I want to give for misordered or disordered remembering. What happens is, I think religious communities are particularly prone to this because faith is something that is handed down, right? The Latin term traditio, from which we get tradition, means to hand down. So precisely because the faith is something that is handed down, we can start imagining or confusing faithfulness with preserving the past, turning back the clock, rather than gratefully receiving a legacy that is meant to propel us forward. I think the most significant problem with nostalgia is not with what it remembers. It's what it actively forgets. Nostalgia is a form of remembering that is also a form of active forgetting. There's a line from, I have a real thing about Antarctica. And one of my top of my bucket list is to get to Antarctica. But there is an amazing travel memoir of sorts written by somebody who was with Shackleton in 1910 or 1913, called Cherry Apsley Gerard is the author. And the book, by the way, is called, spoiler alert, The Worst Journey in the World. And it's a tome like this. But there is a line in there where Cherry Gerard says this: "So much of the trouble of this world is caused by memories, for we only remember half." The past that is pined for in nostalgia is always selected, edited, preserved in amber, and then decontextualized at the same time that it's kind of invoked as marching orders for the present. Whenever the past is invoked in this way, the first question we should always ask is, whose past? Whose version of the past is this? What does this invoked past ignore, override, and actively forget? Okay, which half is recalled? Whose half is forgotten? Nostalgia is a very powerful narcotic today, I think, precisely because people feel like the world is so upended. We all feel that. Like, we, you know, like I was awake at 5 a.m. this morning. I know something's happening in the UK. Go to BBC News. I watch Liz Truss resign her premiership. She's been there for like 41 days. It's like, does everybody feel like every institution around us is just eroding and imploding? And in that sort of turmoil, you can understand why all of a sudden, I got something for you. Let me paint you a picture of a past. Remember when it used to be like this? Remember when America was great? Tony Soprano. Remember when is the lowest form of conversation. Remember when America was great? Remember when we did this? Remember when it was like this? And you just always have to ask yourself, remember, memory is crucial, but always ask yourself, what are we forgetting? What's getting left out? It's like some people watched Mad Men. I remember, Banana Republic came out with an entire clothing line based on Mad Men. As if watching Mad Men was like, oh, I wish we could live the 1950s again. Which, if you were a white man who worked on Madison Avenue, it probably was a pretty cool time because the world freaking revolved around you. But if you're a woman or a person of color or poor, 50s is not a great time. So this nostalgia, I think, is so powerful. It's this sentimental pining for the way things were, but the way things were is always a fiction. It's romanticized. It's sentimentalized. And let's notice again, we can fall into personal forms of nostalgia too. And if we fall into these personal forms of nostalgia, what we're really doing is saying, God, I don't really want the things you gave me in the meantime. I want to go back. But you can't. And in fact, to go back would be to spurn those gifts. So, those are some of the temptations. We could talk about more. I will also say, I won't spend as much time on it here, but I also think a very powerful temptation of how to inhabit time right now is despair, is doomsdayism. And I think there are like really heartbreaking secular renditions of that, right? Part of you can understand why that seems plausible, right? Like you get it. I don't think it helps to just be judgmental of despair. You have to sort of enter into it, and then you also have to remember that Thomas Aquinas told us despair is actually the cardinal vice. Because if you can't hope, it shuts down the possibilities of everything else. Which, again, I also think explains a lot about our culture. Okay. What I want to suggest is all of these forms of temporal temptation are really ways of evading time. They are characterized by a certain kind of avoidance of our own historicity and temporality, as if we are trying to escape our creaturehood by making ourselves kind of immune to history. And I want us to realize that if we are allergic to history, we are actually avoiding one of the primary ways and sites in which God meets us. If we don't have a robust theological and spiritual account of precisely why history is one of the arenas of God's activity in the world, then we will actually be missing out on all the ways that God is meeting and shaping us there. It will also mean that we won't have the tools in place to read the particular challenges and injustices of the moment in which we find ourselves. Because when won't matter. We just are sort of floating above time. So I want to, in contrast to those, I guess what I'm commending is what I'm going to call spiritual timekeeping. Spiritual timekeeping. And you can find a lot more about this in the book, but what I mean by spiritual timekeeping, first of all, is absolutely not about what to do spiritually with your time. Do you know what I mean? It's not, I'm not talking about some kind of spiritualized time management. There is not going to be, Jamie Smith branded day timer coming out anytime soon with little quotes that tells you how to do it. That's not what we're talking about. What I mean by spiritual timekeeping is a kind of renewed temporal awareness that is attuned to the texture of our histories and the vicissitudes of life and the tempo of the spirit. So I'm giving you this. This is a famous painting called Vanity, which is often associated with the practice of memento mori, which we get from the Benedictine tradition in particular, which is, remember you will die. It's a key sort of fulcrum of Benedictine spirituality, remember you will die. And so what you get in Vanity is the flower that fades, the time that is passing, the mortality that we face in ourselves. I'm suggesting memento tempore. I made that up. But remember you are temporal. Remember you are a creature who inhabits history. Remember that you are stretched in time. Spiritual timekeeping then is kind of rooted in a wake-up call to the significance of our temporality and awakening to the way that history lives in us. The way we inhabit history and the way history inhabits us. I think this is a a really crucial point. The opening of the book, and in many ways the impetus of this project for me, I'll just be candid, was therapy. And it was in the experience of with a absolutely God-given counselor named Tim Himba, who I will never grow tired of praising and thanking, who journeying with me with Christ, most of that looked like dealing with all the history I carried in my body, the archive of a past that I had tried to live as if it wasn't there. And I think both personally and collectively, we need to sort of grapple with the histories that live in us, precisely so that we can live faithfully into the future to which we are called. So temporal, spiritual timekeeping, as I'm going to talk about it, has sort of three beats to it, if you will. Reckoning, discernment, and hope. Now, the question then that we're trying to talk about is, what does it mean to be faithful if we are creatures who are conditioned by time and history, right? Because we are still called to faithfulness. And by the way, we are called to faithfulness by a God who is the same today, yesterday, and forever, right? We are called to faithfulness by an eternal God. But how, what does it mean to be faithful if we are also creatures who live amidst the vicissitudes of time and the royal of history? Well, I think what happens is, in forms of know-when Christianity, if you talk about faithfulness, the watchword is always preservation. Faithfulness is just kind of understood as the prolongation and preservation of what has been. And so in know-when Christianity, faithfulness is often construed as a matter of guarding against change, and the future is seen as something to be feared. This is also why it fits very well with nostalgia. In spiritual timekeeping, the watchword is discernment. Faithfulness, what does it mean to be faithful? Faithfulness requires knowing when we are in order to discern what we are called to. And the goal of spiritual confrontation with our past, this reckoning, is precisely to rid us of the delusions and idolatries so that we can finally hear what God is calling us to in the present. By the way, when reckoning sounds like a jarring experience, and it often is. But it's not just that, because I think reckoning is also turning to receive the gifts that have been handed down to us, that have been there to make a way of life with Christ possible. So reckoning isn't just sort of like, it doesn't just have to be construed as this sort of negative prophetic experience. Reckoning is also an exercise in gratitude, in reception. It's a kind of receptivity to the past. Again, remember this point from Gutierrez. To hope in Christ is at the same time to believe in the adventure of history. It's very kind of Frodo stuff, in a way. So in spiritual timekeeping, life with God is an adventure because our relationship keeps unfolding in new ways. So in contrast to primitivism, for example, Jesus promises a dynamic work of the Spirit who guides us into truth across time. We're going to talk about this more after the break. That, I'm going to suggest, is actually a fundamental conviction about Catholicity, the Catholicity of the Spirit's work across time. Your history with God comes with you, of course, but the story is still unfolding. So listening to the Spirit is not just an archaeological dig for some original deposit. It's an attunement to the God who is with us. In some ways, the most significant name for God in spiritual timekeeping is Emmanuel. Emmanuel, God with us, present with us. God is with us, still speaking, still surprising, still revealing, and it's more like listening for what God can build given the layers of the past that are underneath you. So in the end, spiritual timekeeping is really about keeping time with the Spirit. It's ultimately a futural exercise. What does it look like for us to be a kingdom come people animated by the Spirit who have reckoned with our histories and given what we have come through? What is God calling us to now? What does he want to unleash in us? Well, how does he want to deploy our histories? That sense of keeping time with the Spirit is not a regimental, you know, left, right, left, right. I want to say that keeping time with the Spirit is more like a subtle dance. It's a responsive feel for what comes next. Or think of it this way. Think of keeping time with the Spirit as this sort of symphonic exercise. I read this great little book, old book, by Lionel Salter, who was a famous British conductor, called How to Listen to Music. And in it, he talks about what a conductor does in an orchestra. And I love this description. He says, the conductor has to judge the proper tempo of the work and indicate it clearly to the orchestra by the movements of his baton. But the thing is, this is not just a mechanical process. If it was, somebody could just take a metronome, set it up here, get it tick-tocking, and then the orchestra would know exactly what to do. But no symphony has the same time the whole way through. You have to actually respond to different moments. What the music requires of the orchestra changes over the course of the symphony. So if the tempo was just this mechanical factor, the metronome would be enough. But in fact, what has to happen is, what is the conductor doing? The conductor is telling us when to speed up, when to slow down, when to get loud and Tchaikovsky booming, and when to get quiet, sotto voce, right? And all of that, in all of that, the conductor is reading the score and inviting us to respond in different rhythms, in different tempos, for the sake of playing this out. And I think that is a beautiful, beautiful illustration of what the Spirit is doing. That there is a sense in which the Spirit is conducting us in ways that are responsive to the moment. When to urge on, when to yield. That discernment is at the very heart of our mission as the body of Christ, if we are going to be faithful in the now in which we find ourselves.
Thanks so much for listening to part one of How to Inhabit Time with James K.A. Smith. Take a stretch break, do what you need to do, then come back for part two of Jamie's talk, which is available right now on the Together PDX podcast.